We're in the early days of spring, and this is the time of year that I personally like to reset. You know, like forget January 1st when I'm just trying to get through the winter. Spring is when I'm really trying to make some big life changes, which means that it's also time for some spring cleaning. But in my quest to turn my life around, there is one thing standing in my way, the laundry chair. You know that chair you probably also have in your room. It's the place where I put my semi-used clothes that aren't quite ready for the hamper, but that I probably shouldn't put back in the dresser either. And no matter how much I clean, that chair and that pile of clothing is always there.
Normal. The laundry chair is something that I think about a lot. I have one. I call it Clothes Mountain, and it's actually an entire bench, which is an improvement because it used to just be the top of my dresser.
Okay.
But
wow, that's quite a height for...
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, that's why it's Clothes Mountain, you know?
That's Rachel Curzius. She writes about the homes we live in and how they affect so many things in our lives. I wanted to talk to Rachel about how I should feel about my laundry chair, but also how to approach cleanliness and style and comfort in my living space, because she has this really fascinating perspective on what these things say about us. From the newsroom of The Washington Post, this is Post Reports. I'm Elahe Izadi. It's Saturday, April 6th. We are bringing you the latest in our occasional series on how to reset aspects of your life. Today, how to keep our homes clean and stylish. Rachel has talked to so many people and experts about cleanliness in the home, and we dig into those debates. Plus, Rachel gives practical tips on how to make any living space feel like yours. I mean, what did the experts you spoke to say about this idea of a laundry chair? Like, is it clean? Is it like a good idea to have this kind of chair?
I think the most important thing to say is it's not a bad idea, right? Like, is it a great idea to just have things pile up and pile up and pile up to no end? Not necessarily, but it's also unrealistic to expect that we're all going to put everything away every single time we use it. And the benefits include the fact that you shouldn't launder, for example, your jeans or your sweaters every time you wear them.
So there's like a climate benefit to
this. There's a climate benefit and a benefit to your clothes. The wear and tear of the laundry is too much for so many things to go through every single cycle. So there's that benefit. And then there's also this idea that it's basically a visual to-do list. For example, at the bottom of my clothes mountain is a pair of pants that I need to reattach a button. Mm-hmm. Have those been there since late November? Yes. And that's why they're at the bottom of clothes mountain.
Yeah.
But one expert that I spoke to said that even the fact that you are making a pile somewhere that isn't the floor, right? You're already wrenching order from chaos.
Oh my gosh, I feel so much better about my laundry chair. So, Rachel, I also wanted to get more into cleanliness habits in people's home. I mean, these are just such personal things. And one of the biggest debates that I hear of all the time is whether to take your shoes off in the house or to keep them on. And I have to disclose for the record, I am very pro shoes off. Like, shoes need to come off in my house. If you come to my house, if anyone listening comes to my house, like, you can't take a few steps in before I'm like, I'm sorry, I don't care who you are. Your shoes have to come off.
How do you say it?
I'm like, can you take your shoes off?
Yeah. I have a special voice for when I say it. I'm like, would you mind taking your shoes off?
No, I don't want the open to be like the mind. Like, the shoes must come off because it's my
non-negotiable.
Home. Non-negotiable because it's my home. And this is how the level of cleanliness that I have in my house. But I wanted to know more about the science of this. Like, I think it's gross to wear shoes inside the house, but does the science support my very strong position on this?
The science.
Yeah.
So there are a lot of different kinds of science, and different scientists I spoke to said different things on this topic. So the first is that germs are everywhere, and most of them aren't bad for you. So yes, you are tracking in germs on your shoes, just like you're tracking them in on your clothes or on your dog's paws or wherever, but that doesn't necessarily mean that your home is a vector of disease, right? So it's actually harder than you think for wearing shoes inside to lead to illness. And if you go barefoot in your home, like no socks, no slippers, that could actually lead to a strain on your feet, especially if you have hard floors, like a wood floor or something like that. So there are compelling reasons, like a podiatrist says, if you're just barefoot all of the time, you might need to come see me.
Oh.
So there are reasons at least not to be so worried about the people who leave their shoes on in the house.
Mm-hmm.
But you are talking to me, a person who also is no shoes in the house. Take your shoes off.
It's very polarizing, I will say. But I mean, it's interesting you're saying that the germs are everywhere and that you are tracking them into your house. But then there's a different question as to whether it could make you sick.
Right. Like, there are germs. That's just a fact of life. And the question is, are they harmful? Could they cause you or your loved ones harm in the home? And so, even if most of them don't cause harm necessarily, mm-hmm. it can still be pretty gross, right? Like, if you want your home to be a place where you feel comfortable, the fact that shoes can track fecal matter to such a large degree,
yeah.
it's like, as soon as we're talking about fecal matter, I'm like, what if it's not on my floor?
Yeah.
I don't know. Like, call me wild.
Let's avoid
the fecal matter. Like, that's just me.
Yeah.
That's my perspective.
Yeah. But are there other hacks for people who want to take their shoes off to help with the podiatrist part of this conversation?
Absolutely. So that would just be wear good slippers. Wear supportive shoes inside the household that are inside shoes only.
I see.
And that's basically what the podiatrist recommends. I'll also say, in addition to fecal matter, and oh my God, now I've said that phrase so many times, but in addition to that, there are other potential things that your shoes can track in, like mostly dirt and soil from outside, which can include metals, even lead.
Mm.
So environmental scientists definitely say, take off your shoes.
And yeah.
the majority of American households take off their shoes when they come home.
Really?
Yes.
This is news to me.
Yes. But they don't necessarily tell their guests to take off their shoes.
Oh, interesting.
And maybe that's more of a not necessarily feeling comfortable imposing on people in that way. And to me, I'm like, you're imposing on me. You're coming into my home. I put a bench right by the door.
Yeah.
Candidly, it's become a place to plop things, but I'll clear it a little bit
yeah.
so that people can take off their shoes.
I guess I'm in the militant minority of forcing it as well.
But I am too.
Yeah. But I think a lot of these things are cultural. I think another related debate to this, it's like a cousin of it, is the indoor-outdoor clothes conversation. So the idea here is whether you should take off the clothing that you were wearing outside once you get home. So you're not, for instance, sitting on your couch in the same pants that you were sitting on while you were riding the bus, which is something I think about a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I was on the bus, or if I'm in New York on the subway or something, you know. And I wonder, is there any proof that it's actually unclean to wear the clothes that you wore outside once you're inside the house?
So clean and unclean are interesting terms, right?
Mm.
Because, yeah, they've got germs on them, but so does your couch, you know? So you're not going to get rid of germs, even if you're just changing when you get home into your indoor clothes. The question is, will those germs harm you? There have been some infections traced back to textiles, but those aren't really clothes. That's like in a locker room if people are sharing damp towels. And if that's not happening in your house, then you're probably in the clear when it comes to illness. So if you're concerned about that, the number one thing to do, wash your hands. Wash your hands when you come home. Wash them again. Keep washing your hands if illness is your main concern. A lot of people that I spoke to about outside clothes, it was more about wanting to feel clean and feel comfortable.
So tell me more about that, the people you spoke to about the indoor-outdoor clothes thing. And I feel like some of this is cultural. And what were their strong feelings? And what did those feelings reveal to you about their relationship to this topic?
I would say most people who had a really strict indoor clothes, outdoor clothes, were raised in households where that was the case.
Hmm.
So people didn't come by it later in life, with a couple of exceptions of people who started working in medical fields and then realized, oh, like I should probably take off my clothes when I come home or change my clothes. And it also had to do with this idea of comfort, which means a couple of things. First of all, it's if I'm wearing jeans, maybe when I'm going to lounge inside, I'd rather wear pants with elastic than pants with buttons and zippers.
Who wouldn't?
But also this idea of comfort, especially as it relates to the bed, right? People were especially strict about the idea, no outside clothes in the bed, because the bed is like this sacrosanct place.
That's how I feel. No outside clothes in the bed for sure.
Right. Because you just want to be comfortable. You don't want to be thinking like, did I sit in that sticky thing in the bus? What was exactly that texture? And now is it in my sheets?
Like, yeah. It's like a psychological thing more than actually is this like the idea of clean and unclean is just as much psychological as it is anything else.
Yeah. Psychological and like sociologically built.
Right. You know, the other thing I think about is how people have changed their homes and living spaces to support cleanliness. Mm. And I think one of the big things, trends that I noticed, especially during the pandemic, was people buying bidets and installing these attachments in their bathroom. So like, I don't know if this is TMI, but I did this, and I don't know how I lived life before having this in my home. Is this a pandemic-era trend that you found in your reporting has outlasted and will stick and continue to grow?
1,000%. It was so funny because I was really curious about exactly what you're talking about. All of the people who faced the great toilet paper shortage of 2020 and decided this is my moment to get a bidet attachment. Instead of having to buy an entirely separate appliance, you can get something that attaches to the toilet you already have that cleans you. And I just wanted to talk to people a couple years later and be like, how'd that go for you? Because it was widely reported at the time that the bidet industry saw a huge boost.
And a lot of people bought things during the pandemic, during that era that, you know, had a huge boost. So how is this different than those?
A lot of people have felt regrets about their purchases or at least no longer use them, right? I mean, there's been reporting about people regretting their Pelotons, people even regretting buying their houses because the house prices were so inflated.
Mm-hmm.
So I was open in my reporting to finding people who felt any kind of way about their bidet.
Mm-hmm.
I was floored by every single person I talked to was exactly what you're saying. Life-changing. I will never live without it. I don't know what I was doing before. I mean, like, the way it felt almost religious. Like, it felt kind of cult-like. I was like, and I kept saying to my editor, I was like, but I got to find someone who regrets it. Like, I got to find someone who regrets it.
Can't,
and at a certain point, she was like, Rachel, like, if they're not there, you can't find them. And I'll say, after the story came out, I did hear from someone who was a property manager who said that they actually banned bidet attachment installations because so many people attached them poorly that it led to flooding and
you gotta
stuff
be careful.
Like that. Right.
And that aside.
But the people who had attached their bidet correctly and have been enjoying the flow of water to clean themselves after using the restroom, they're all thrilled. And if you think about it, it makes so much sense because we clean everything that's dirty with water except for what? Ourselves?
Yeah, it's nuts.
We just use dry paper. And so, you know, and just for some context here, it's like the United States didn't like invent the bidet. In fact, we're very much behind.
Right.
And the United States uses more toilet paper per capita than any other country and is still like quite behind many other countries in the rest of the world when it comes to bidet usage. But that market hasn't shrunk.
Which
it
is
fascinating.
It
continues to grow, just not at the same rapid clip as it did during the pandemic.
Well, it's fascinating because like so many other things didn't continue to grow. Do you have any of those statistics or do we know like any of the numbers around this?
So every bidet manufacturer I spoke to basically told me during the pandemic, it was the wildest time of their business. Tushy, one bidet attachment company, had their business growing fivefold in 2020. And since then, it has continued to grow by about 20%.
Wow, that's a huge number.
Which is pretty, and I said, I was like, you know, do you see this slowing down anytime soon? And they were like, no, because the goal is every bathroom. And we're nowhere near every bathroom.
Yeah. And it also sounds like, you know, less toilet paper usage is better for the environment, potentially. I mean, you're using water, but water probably goes into the production of toilet paper. And it sounds like America, in my perspective, is getting cleaner.
I don't know if America overall is getting cleaner. Maybe some of our behinds are.
After the break, Rachel shares tips on how to decorate and transform a space, even if you're just renting. We'll be right back.
This podcast is sponsored by Skylight Frame. Mother's Day is almost here. What are you getting her? Something that shows you care. Something that makes her feel loved. Something that won't stress you out. Something like the Skylight Frame. The Skylight Frame is the perfect gift. It's a touchscreen photo frame your whole family can upload photos to, from wherever they are in the world. It's a way to share with her all the moments that matter. It sets up in seconds. You can even make sure that it's already loaded with photos when your mom opens her Mother's Day gift. And her Skylight Frame can hold thousands of the treasured photos you share. It's an easy, heartfelt way for mom to stay connected with those who matter most. It really is the perfect gift. Now, as a special Mother's Day offer for our listeners, get 15% off your purchase of a Skylight Frame when you go to skylightframe.com/easy. That's SKYLIGHTFRAME.com/easy. Get 15% off your Mother's Day purchase now at skylightframe.com/easy.
So, Rachel, now I want to talk about other changes that people can make to their living spaces this spring, not just for them to be cleaner, but to freshen it up and make it feel new again. I feel like there's this inclination when looking at how to redecorate to just go with what feels really trendy or what you're seeing in your social media feeds. But is that how I should be thinking about remodeling my space?
There has been this broader kind of shift towards standardization. So this is often called like the HGTV effect or the HGTVification of our homes. It's this idea that neutrals reign supreme and people are trying to make their place kind of inoffensive or as appealing to as many people as possible.
Oh, because that's like when we're watching these HGTV shows, they all sort of remodel it looking kind of the same way.
Exactly. Uh-huh. And so one study found that HGTV and these other home renovation media actually led homeowners to remodel with the next owner in mind. So they weren't even doing it based off of their taste. What will work on the marketplace. And the wildest part of this is that they have this in mind, even if they had no intention of selling.
I mean, that's so sad to
me. Isn't that so depressing?
It's sad to me because, I mean, I get the like just economics of it maybe, but at the same time, your home is supposed to be, in the ideal way, your sanctuary, your refuge. And if you can't like even be present in it for yourself, then kind of like, what's the point?
Right.
So as someone who can get overwhelmed when trying to make decisions about, you know, my clothes or how to decorate, I'm wondering if now you can walk me through some of the more practical questions or ways to think about redecorating my space. So first, I want to ask you, what's a way in which I can change up my space that makes sense if I'm renting it?
So I recently wrote a story about renters who were just refusing to wait to make their spaces feel like home. And it ended up feeling deeply hopeful. This idea that, look, this is my space, and the way that I make it mine isn't necessarily through a down payment and a mortgage. It's through putting my personal touch everywhere, and when I go there, it feels like home. So the first thing you should do is check your lease, make sure that you're not going to get in huge amounts of trouble if you're making changes, and you could even write a letter to your landlord to make sure you have their approval in writing for things that you think might be an issue.
Mm-hmm.
Let's say you don't want to go that route. You don't want to do these kind of like larger changes. Hang up art. You could paint your apartment a bold or exciting color. You could add floating shelves, put up window treatments. There are so many ways that you can impart your style and make it feel like your home. And I will say, I got a lot of strong reactions to that story. And the renters who participated did as well. A lot of people were saying that, oh, this is a waste of money.
Yeah.
And one of the women I spoke to, Imani Keel, told me that she always thinks that that's such a ridiculous argument.
Why?
Because people don't think that if you go out to dinner or if you go on vacation, that that's a waste of money.
And that's like a fleeting
right.
experience.
Those are even more fleeting. She's you know, you spend 10 days going on vacation. I live in my apartment 365 days. Like, why wouldn't I spend money to make that a place that feels good to me?
That's an interesting argument. That's my argument for spending a good chunk of change on my hair. I wear it every day.
Yeah. I mean, and that's why people will spend a lot of money on, say, a coat or a pair of shoes, because it's like you can get your money's worth.
What's a common way people think about their homes that could potentially be misguided?
People are always thinking about how their home looks. And I think it's because they're often taking photos for social media, et cetera. But how something looks is just one of the senses that we use to experience our home, right? Like, I could have a really nice looking couch, but if I sit on it and I can't sink into it, what use is it?
Yeah.
And I think that a photo can't really capture how a place smells or just the vibe or even music that you might be playing. So I think that embracing all five of your senses when it comes to decorating your lived space is really important. And then that sixth most important sense, vibes. Like, just how do you feel there?
Yeah.
If you feel good there, then you're doing a good job.
Yeah. So Rachel, what are some of the things I should be thinking about when I'm buying furniture or decor for my space? So, you know, walk me through some of the considerations I should be keeping in mind here.
The first thing is, it totally depends on your budget, right? Like,
right.
I can't tell you, like, oh, you should buy some really expensive furniture if you don't have the money to do that.
Yeah.
It's interesting, I think, to look at what choices for consumers look like right now. Furniture is significantly more shoddily made than it used to be. And there are a couple of reasons for that. One of the main ones is just that the materials people are using are less expensive, and so they don't last. And also because manufacturing has basically moved to places in the world where labor is cheaper. So they're shipping you your furniture, and it's all flat pack shipped.
Oh.
So when you get a desk that is in a really flat box and you're putting it together yourself, it's just not going to last as long because you're not using the kind of old joinder techniques that furniture makers had used for centuries. So if you do have the money to make investment in higher quality furniture, you might be better off. But here's the trick. Sometimes really expensive furniture is also really shoddily made.
Oh, really? So how do I know?
So the most surefire way to guarantee quality is if you buy custom furniture, but that's so expensive. It's prohibitively expensive for most people. So that's like an heirloom piece that you could have for generations, but I don't really think it's realistic for most of us.
Mm-hmm.
Another way is just try and avoid that flat packed furniture. If it comes in a tiny box, it's just not going to last you very long. It's almost like a single-use piece of furniture.
Mm, interesting.
So you kind of want to read the fine print. Solid wood sounds really good, but not all wood is created equal. The kind of wood matters. So rubber tree isn't as good as oak or maple, but you can buy good quality secondhand furniture. Facebook Marketplace is a great place to look for that, as well as a lot of vintage stores. And a lot of those pieces, because they were made decades ago and you can buy them, that's kind of like the proof is in the pudding, right? It's already lasted decades.
Oh, so it's likely to continue to last many more decades.
That's right.
And, you know, then there's the factor of waste as well. Like,
right,
you're reusing something instead of making something new. So, Rachel, after, you know, spending so much time thinking about and talking to people about and being inside of people's homes, what is the one piece of advice you would give me as I'm looking at my space and thinking about what to do this spring?
I would first of all say give yourself a break. I think that we're all really harsh on ourselves when we look at our homes, and our homes are works in progress. So are we, but especially our homes. Like, I love the idea that my home is something that I can continue to futz with and change around, and that it will never be a finished product. It'll always be kind of a representation of where I'm at right now. But also I'll say that sometimes I will avoid doing really simple tasks that actually make me feel great once I do them. Like, I have a table right by the door that ends up accumulating a bunch of mail and other odds and ends. If I spend 5 minutes decluttering it, then when I walk into my home, I feel a much greater sense of peace. So those small tasks can actually make a really huge difference.
It's so beautiful because this is such a reflection of how we feel about ourselves inside and how we feel about our own lives. It's outward expression is our homes.
Yes. Yeah. And I think that that's why the home is such an apt metaphor for so many things when it comes to human connection or when it comes to your own life. It's like when you let someone in, you know, you're letting them into your home.
But
you're letting
your
them
off.
Into your space. Yeah, exactly. Let them in with conditions.
Rachel, thank you so much for joining us today. This was great.
Thanks for having me.
Rachel Curzius is a reporter for the Home You Own section at The Post. That's it for Post Reports. Thanks for listening. Today's show was produced by Sabi Robinson. It was mixed by Sean Carter and edited by Lucy Perkins. Thanks also to Maggie Penman. I'm Elahe Izadi. We'll be back on Monday with more stories from The Washington Post.
Hey, this is Christina Quinn. I'm the host of Try This, the Washington Post's new series of audio courses. The idea behind Try This is to become better functioning humans without having to comb the internet for countless hours. In our first course, we learned how to sleep better. Now, we're going to learn how to make our friendships stronger. I'll offer expert tips that are doable, and I'll keep it short. So let's do this. Classes in session. Find Try This from the Washington Post wherever you listen.